with love from lockdown. I think I may grow to love this place like a groupie with Stockholm syndrome. See how our pond thickens with spawn, how the frog's roiling orgy creates the slow TV of full stop to comma. Maybe the spiders will multiply now, surprised by our sudden stillness, wanting to fill our cleaned corners with their mysteries. I think there are underground movements we have yet to discover, sly mobs waiting to rise and scooter around our naivety. Perhaps I will make nettle soup, catch them young. It will last for days, coating my cold, redundant tongue. I think all the dogs are twitching through anxiety dreams where they wake up and there's no one to throw their spitty balls. It seems the stars can see us again, or rather, we can see them, or so we think, long dead blinks in the newly night sky. I think the road markings will be next to go, that the verges have always known how to creep blade by blade. Maybe one day I'll breathe easy again, step out and part the air like Moses.
Welcome to LGIU Fortnightly. I'm Ingrid Kohler. We open with a poem from Sue Burge. She's a nationally recognized poet. We'll hear more from her, as well as from Abby Brown, the leader of Stoke-on-Trent, Karen Campbell, a writer in residence at a council, and from our very own staff. This is all part of a week of reflection that we're doing at LGIU that you can find on our website. It's called Unlocked, Local Stories from a Global Pandemic. And I'm here with Jonathan Carr-West, our chief executive, to talk about the podcast part of this week.
Hi, Ingrid.
Hey.
How's your year been?
So I've been horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been, I think, without a doubt, one of the worst years of my life. And that's because I had some personal stuff, some horrible, horrible personal stuff going on at the same time as the lockdown. And it just kind of, I don't know, created its own little kind of weird bubble of awful, not being able to reach out. But on the other side of things, like, I can see how lucky I have been to be able to have productive work. And in fact, work-wise, I think it's been, I mean, there were some ups and downs, obviously, but I think work-wise it's been a really good year.
Yeah.
And
I mean, part of your work is just chatting with me here.
Yeah, exactly. And that's been great. Right? What a weird year. So, yeah. How about you?
I mean, look, it's certainly been weird, hasn't it? So we're coming up for a year. Mark the first anniversary of the first lockdown. We're recording this podcast because we're putting out a whole bunch of material at LGIU to mark that, to think about what people in local government have done, but also how it's been, how it's felt for them, which is why, you know, we opened with a poem, we've got short stories, we've got all sorts of interesting things that we'll tell people all about. But, you know, I guess I was reflecting just on, you know, that if thinking back a year, it feels extraordinary just how completely things have changed. I mean, the first thing to say, I guess, is that, you know, we are, you know, you do have to think about where you've been lucky, and we have been fortunate for, you know, 100,000 people are dead. For many people are not here this year. For many families, the last year has been one of unimaginable loss and tragedy, and, you know, for many people, you know, even who haven't lost loved ones, people have lost jobs, people have lost livelihoods, people have lost their education, people, you know, so an unbelievable amount of loss just in society as a whole, and I think it's going to take us many years to kind of process that and think that through. So we all started working at home at LJU, what, about a week, 10 days before lockdown was actually called?
I can't remember now because, like, time has no meaning anymore.
Yeah. I want to say March the 12th we did that.
I know I actually stayed home even before that.
Yeah.
So I, the last day that I came into the office, I went out for dinner with someone. And that was the last time I went to a restaurant.
What's that?
I don't. Yeah, exactly. And she then messaged me about a week later and said that she had COVID.
No,
But I was already at home. And I came in. The last time I was in the office was to get the recording equipment for the podcast. I drove in at night after the congestion charge because I'm cheap like that.
I mean, I remember very clearly taking a view that, I mean, we should say, I guess, you know, we're lucky at LJU because we were set up to work from home. You know, what we do is, most of it is delivered online. We were used to working at home because, you know, we use the office as many, you know, many listeners will have been to events in our office. So we were quite used to having, you know, 1 or 2 days a week where everyone worked from home and we had the tech set up and we were used to using it. So in some senses, it, working at home was as little disruptive for us as I could imagine it being for any organization. And so it felt like quite an easy choice in, you know, March last year when we saw which way things were going, you know, ahead of the government issuing instructions, just to say, okay, guys, let's all just work from home while this is. And I don't know. I don't remember how long I thought that would be for. And I sort of thought it might be for longer than, yeah, I remember saying, let's, you know, we'll do that until May or March. Or, you know, we had these different, and I remember thinking it might be longer than that, but it never, I don't think it ever occurred to me that a year later we still would be working from home. We would still be in our third lockdown. We wouldn't have been back into the office. I didn't think that. I kind of thought, well, gosh, this might last until the summer. You know, we should be prepared for a bit of a long haul. But I just didn't think it would be. It would be like that. And I think that has been an adaptation for us. And of course, it's been an adaptation. Yeah, far more of an adaptation for all our members, for councils around the country, you know, as it has for other workplaces. But, you know, by and large, we had to adjust some of our working patterns, and we'll talk about this later, get used to working remotely. But it's, you know, we were in quite a fortunate position that it was a relatively small, the fact of working at home was a relatively small change for us. What's been extraordinary is the duration of it and the sort of, that we are only doing that.
Or working from home while trying to school your kids.
I don't even want to talk about that. That's
You've like blocked that out of your head. I think that listeners really want to hear about the innovation that your daughter has come up with.
That she refers genius. To everyone at LGIU as the deletables. And if she, it's yes, I sort of inadvertently taught her
She's
to distinguish.
She's very young, by the way.
She's only 4. I taught her to distinguish, you know, in an attempt, thinking I was doing the right thing, to distinguish between calls with you guys, with guys from the team, which I was happy for her to interrupt, and, you know, then trying to sort of carve out a sort of distinction where you go, well, actually, but then there are some calls I have to make. Yeah, so kind of an extension of, you know, the workplace and LJU, we're a team, you know, the kind of family atmosphere, so fine. If the kids want to wander in and sort of see people on and chat to them, that's fine, and then trying to make the distinction that there are then some calls with kind of external people where I'd rather not, you know, where I need to kind of, which led to her christening all of you the deletables, because these were the calls she felt entitled to come in and start trying to press the delete button in order to have my attention, which again, I thought was sort of okay until she started calling you to your faces. Going, oh no, it's just, Daddy, it's just the deletables. I'll delete them. It's like, no, they still matter, right? They're still people. They're still important. So my attempts to be all kind of like, on the one hand, all like, you know, I'm here for everyone, I want to be a sort of open, you know, I'm available, you know, do reach out for me, I want to support the team. My daughter was just like, no, delete them, they don't, get rid of them.
She just said, just a couple of weeks ago, she wandered into one of those external meetings, actually,
she did.
And you said to her, sorry, you know, these are the very important people. You need to like back off. And she recognized me and she's like, no, Ingrid's deletable. Just smashing the button.
I know. So then, yeah, then a sort of third category of no, because sometimes the deletables are also in the calls with. So yeah, that's been fun. I don't miss homeschool. I don't think it was good for them. I don't think it was good for me. I don't think it was good for, actually, I don't think it was that bad for LGIU. I mean, I guess I sort of fluctuated between thinking, you know, I just don't really add very much and they can manage without me, or I've created a sort of well-functioning, efficient machine that can sort of function without
it's
me.
The latter.
I have deliberately not been interrogating that question very hard. But look, it's been difficult, and I am conscious, and you know, there are some people, you know, so you've had kids at home, several of our colleagues are in the same position, others are not, and you know, they have probably picked up a bit, you know, probably done, they have done extra and picked up slack from those of us who haven't been able to devote as much time to work as we would normally do. Yeah, other people have been sitting there with nothing else to do but work, and they've, so I think it's hard. It's hard for everyone in different ways. And I think it's been, and I think there is a thing about just accepting that. Just saying, look, this is kind of an unfair, difficult situation for everyone, and it's unfair on different people in different ways, but that's what it is. You know, there's no way around that. We're all in the position we're in. And of course, it's, but you know, I mean, it hasn't been like that for everyone. I mean, some of us have had to adjust more than others. You've been talking to Barry for this podcast, Barry O'Brien, who's leads up our learning and development work. So I kind of gaily say, well, most of what we do is online. Not what Barry did. His job was about people sitting in a room and trainers and learning, and you know, he had to sort of completely, you know, so he had to completely rejig what he did and how he did it and take it online, which, you know, he did pretty much overnight. And it must be said, with astonishing success. You spoke to him about that.
I did, and he was so enthusiastic, and he deserves to be, because he did change his whole model of delivery in a very short period of time, and has actually found ways of success that, I mean, it was successful before, but it's even more successful. How we've not just adapted to how we deliver stuff, but what we're delivering. So let's hear from him.
My name is Barry O'Brien. I'm currently the Learning and Development Coordinator at the LGIU, and have been for over a year or two now. We're here to support local authorities and in any way around learning development.
So Barry, you have been heading up our learning and development offer, our course offer, for a little while, a couple years, I think, and doing a tremendous job, I have to say. But the job that you did 2 years ago has been, in a lot of ways, very different from the job that you're doing right now, to the pandemic. And you delivered a lot of courses face-to-face. They were well attended. They came into our office, and now, I mean, we still have the office, but I haven't seen it in a year. What was that like, flipping from, I don't want to say very traditional, but it was, you know, pretty traditional service, to a virtual one overnight?
Yeah, I think it was a bit of a shock, because initially it was kind of, oh my God, what do we do? But I'd already kind of been talking about this with my trainers for actually over a year anyway. So in a sense, I was already talking it, because partly not because LGIU is now broadening its wings to become international, but more to do with the fact that actually just traveling within England, you know, transport, cost of train fares and hotel accommodation, etc., you know, it sometimes makes better sense to better be there virtually. If we'd asked this question 2 years ago and said, right, we're all going to do this online, how long would it have taken organisations to change? It would have taken a lot longer, but when needs must we seemed to be able to find the solution fairly quickly. So I think in a sense there was a drive, an incentive to move to online, and that just accelerated with the pandemic. So strangely, in some ways, this has been a positive in more ways than one for us, and I think it's been a great benefit to local authorities up and down the country, and indeed more broadly. I mean, we're getting people from Scotland, the Republic of Ireland, Wales, people that probably wouldn't have travelled to London for an open session, but definitely can easily come to an online session. It's much more friendly for their perspective, not just in the transport cost, but also just actually just being able to get on with other things. So a lot of the sessions we'd be doing online are about an hour or 2 hours in length. I mean, we do have one that's about 4 hours, which is what we call the 4 hour wonder, because it's all about project management. But, you know, it has a couple of breaks in. But yeah, I mean, they've been working really great. And more recently, we've been doing some evening sessions, just started doing some of our very popular chairing skill sessions that have worked really well, more so because a lot of councillors are adjusting to how to work in the online format. You know, it's a totally different beast to being in a room, you know, in the chamber, council chamber, and there's about 40 or so councillors. It's a totally different environment, and it's how you adjust to that. How do you ensure that you're picking up everybody's perspective and bringing those in, understanding the technology as well? So often local authorities, it may be helped by the member services or democratic services of the local authority, but sometimes, you know, especially with councils doing their own surgeries or more local meetings, they'll be using Zoom, probably not Microsoft Teams, which local authorities tend to use. And so it's having a bit of a clue and understanding about those aspects, which you wouldn't necessarily need to know about if you were sitting in front of a group of people, but definitely do when you're on an online setting.
But that was the course we offered before, wasn't it? We offered like a chairing course that became an online chairing course. So some of the skills are the same, being a good chair, but some of the skills are, well, very different, in fact, yeah.
Indeed. And it's always popular. I mean, there's always, we get interest every year. It's one of those courses where we're always having interest for, and it's partly because, you know, they're new elected members, but also the structure of local authorities, particularly if they're a council who's never experienced local government before, you know, adjusting to that, they need to understand the processes, the protocols, the standing orders, etc. So those are the things that, you know, someone who's been asked to be a chair would need to be aware of.
Yeah, no, we were talking about the online chairing stuff and how different that is. And having facilitated this year events, it's like you bring your facilitation skills that you had before in the face-to-face world, but it is different, and it does help to have that benefit. But then you mentioned elections, so that's my favorite topic, as you know. So
yes.
we'll talk about that. So elections this May. Finally,
indeed.
Super Thursday, I think they're calling it.
Wow.
And we have you've very kindly organized a course.
Indeed, we
for
have.
For elections. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, we actually, interestingly, in 2019, we started doing this. We did the personal safety session, and we did a free session then, and that was in the office at the LGRU near King's Cross. And so we provided an option for councillors who are up for election to come in and have a session, a free session, as part of our goodwill, you know, as part of our local elections package that we do every year. Obviously last year that was all put on hold, and now it's all in the online world. We thought we'd do the same thing, and the advantage of course being online is we can get more people can come along. They have more freedom because we're doing a very short sort of hour and a bit session, so it allows people to carry on with whatever else it is they want to do during the course of the day. It's less disruptive for them, and they can just get a snippet of information about how to sort of deal with their own personal safety, just get some ideas about how to improve it. Particularly, it's been quite, you know, pertinent what's been going on in the news recently. But generally, I just think it's about just being more alert. And obviously, we'll mention being careful with regards to COVID, but more generally, just how to conduct yourself and be aware of your environment.
As a councillor or as a candidate?
As indeed an individual, not just as a councillor. I mean, obviously, there are aspects you need to be aware of, such as canvassing, So that will be, we'll be discussing that. But also more broadly, this, although this is a free session and it's just an hour, there is a range of other sessions that we're putting on that complement this session. So yes, we'll be doing a fuller version of the session later in the year after the local elections. And also next month, we're doing a new one, which is looking at, you know, things get really bad. And this is a very rare situation, of course, most of the time, being able to deal with intense situations where maybe it's getting a bit vocal. You know, there are techniques in terms of managing conflict. We're running one of those. We have been running quite a few managing conflict sessions. Particularly that's useful online, but also for meetings such as chairing. You may get some of people, particularly the members of the public, but it could also be other fellow councillors, and it gets a bit heated, and you know, you need to sort of take things down a few peg or two just to calm things down, and sort of techniques about how to do that. So we've got a new one that's coming up as well in April, which is looking at some defence techniques. So we've actually got an ex-police, I think, inspector, who actually is also a councillor for one of the local authorities in England, who also will be providing us some techniques. It'd be interesting because it'd be online, but there's some really interesting points that might be of interest to certain people who just want to know that, just for peace of mind, and just know certain things that you don't, you know, that you don't need to go to a judo lesson or a karate lesson to understand. They're techniques that are relatively straightforward. So, but that's one of many. So
we've got that.
We'll be looking at transactional analysis, which is an interesting sort of way of understanding conflict, which goes back way back to the 70s, and it's that kind of I'm okay, you're okay, I'm not okay, you're okay, and so on and no one, yeah, it goes on. There's quite a lot on at the moment.
There is, and of course we will have a full package of support for any councillors who will be taking office in May.
Indeed.
As well, and that will all be on the website and local elections, and you'll be hearing more about local elections on the podcast soon, because you know you can never get me to stop talking about elections. Oh my gosh, I don't know if you heard that, but my partner was just in the background saying true that, she never stops talking about elections. Yeah, it is true. So
Well, we're about democracy, Ingrid, so that's...
Hey, it's a good thing.
That's the thing, isn't it? Yeah, it's good.
Barry, you have done amazing work, and I think you've actually managed to get way more people through the virtual door in the last year. So in that sense, that is great. But it has been a lot of work, and it has been a lot of pressure, I assume. How do you think that experience has helped you or changed you in a professional sense? Like, what have you got from that experience?
It's been quite intense, really, in some ways, because the amount of interest, in some ways it's been a victim to a certain degree of its success, because so many people now find that so really useful, and the feedback we've had has been quite positive from a lot of sessions. Indeed, we get some people coming through quite a lot of the online program that we've been providing. Yeah, I must admit, there was at the end of the year, I was thinking, gosh, I could do with a rest now. It's this full on, being brilliant from the perspective of the officer, local government officer or elected member, because which is what we're about. We're here to support. We're looking internationally, and that opens up a whole set of new ideas as well. So recordings, videos, maybe animations.
It's been great chatting with you about this, Barry, in a more conversational way than we would normally do. And thanks so much. And I hope you enjoy the slight lull as we head into elections.
Yeah, I mean, fantastic stuff from Barry. And look, I have to confess, when he said to me, look, I want to take it all online, I thought, great, let's do that, because doing it is better than not doing it. I thought it would be okay. I thought, you know, we'll sort of hang in there. It will be a kind of, we'll keep our hands in the sort of, I didn't, you know, he did, I didn't anticipate that it would be more successful than what he did in person. So we had, you know, well over 1,000 people coming through those programs last year, which, you know, huge increase, because it's so much easier for people to attend. So, you know, it's one of the areas where you know, I don't know what the new normal will look like, but you know, certainly that online component will be part of it, because we want to keep doing bits of that as we go forward. But you know, Harry's not the only person who's had changes at LJU. I mean, that's been normal, but we've also had new people joining us over the last year.
That's been weird.
Yeah, I mean, not because they're weird.
No,
I mean,
they're not.
They've been great, but again, you know, two. Not something I would have chosen. Well, I would have. I guess I would have done because we had to do it. But two, a recruitment process that had already started pre-lockdown, and that we then said, okay, you know, we'll do that on. You know, we'll interview online because we want to keep going, and then realizing, oh, these people are actually going to start working from home online, and you know, here we are. I guess they both started sort of April, May last year. And none of us, you know, Melissa and Lucy, you know, great members of the team. Melissa, who leads on our Australian Daily News, Lucy, who leads on a lot of our publishing and our membership data. You know, I've never met them face to face. We've never been in the same room. We've never, and again, that's extraordinary. Possibly more extraordinary for them than for us. Possibly more extraordinary for us than for them. I remember when we did the interviews. And I was doing this big apologetic, well, you know, obviously we'd much rather be meeting you in person. And I'm so sorry. It's very weird doing it over video, isn't it? I know that's very straight. And I couldn't help noticing a bit of a look in both their eyes, which was a bit like, yeah, all right, granddad. I mean, that's kind of how stuff works now. It's not that weird. It's just a video call. Like, this is so, you know, I found it very weird. Whether they found it weird or not, you would have to ask them. Indeed. You did ask them.
I did, yeah. They didn't call you granddad, but they knew I was recording.
Yeah. So look, you interviewed them for, yeah, so we should have said to people, we're having a series of interviews with LJU staff as part of our reflections on what the last year has been like, just to try and kind of reflect that back to people. So you spoke to Melissa and Lucy. New members of the team, post-lockdown members of the team. Let's hear what they had to say.
Hi, I'm Melissa Thorne. I work for LJU. I'm in policy, publishing and editorial officer, and I mainly work on the Australian and global sides of LJU.
Hi, I'm Lucy. I also work at LJU since last April, and I am a policy and membership officer.
So you guys have both been in post for about a year, not quite a year, but about a year, and been working with you for that amount of time, and I've never met you face to face. You've never been in the office. It's a nice office. You've never heard the office banter, the endless, I have to say, endless office banter about the proper water temperature at which to brew coffee. You've missed all those things. I'm selling it, really, aren't I? I'll start with you, Melissa. What's it been like starting a brand new job and never leaving, never, you could just do it from bed if you wanted to.
It's true. Yeah, I'm very used to it now, I have to say, but I think it has been a strange thing because I'd never really worked remotely before. It is weird having worked here for nearly a year and, yeah, having only seen people on a screen, like not really knowing what it will be like to meet in person or talk about other things. So, yeah, I think the main thing when I was thinking about it, it just took like, I feel like I know most people now to a certain extent. I've had individual conversations with quite a lot of people, but it just took a lot longer to get to know people than you would in a traditional office when you would just sort of see people around and talk to people. But it would be months before I sort of met someone beyond a big team meeting, which is a bit strange, really.
Yeah, I definitely echo what Melissa has said, although it has been really fun guessing how tall everyone is from just their face. That's been great. But other than that, yeah, I'm definitely really excited to kind of even though we do have those casual conversations at the beginning and the end of meetings, it feels like very structured. And obviously even the fun is quite like organized fun. It'll be nice to kind of see everyone in a more informal way and kind of hear also what different projects people are working on kind of as they happen, as opposed to kind of when people present them, because it's like really interesting to kind of hear how things got to places. And I feel like in a lot of cases, you kind of just like see the end product because we're not there for the process.
Who do you think is the tallest person in the office?
Surely one of the dudes.
Well, okay. Who do you think is the tallest man? There aren't many men, but yeah.
God, maybe Jonathan or Andrew? Andrew? I'm going to go with Andrew.
You know what? My memory is so hazy. I think it might be Andrew, but yeah. Yeah.
I win. Nice. I'm happy with that.
We'll have to get them standing side by side and see if you are right. I don't know how many jobs you've had before, so this is, but you're quite early on in your careers. What would you say that do you feel you're missing something from the context of the office, and how have you sort of addressed that?
I think certainly at various points, I felt it was that kind of more social, more spontaneous conversations that really either help you to get to know people, but also maybe a spark for more kind of creative conversation and more kind of innovative things rather than more formal discussions. I felt like that was missing from not being face to face with people. But yeah, I think something that I remembered, it's strange because obviously everyone's in the same situation at the moment. Like, it sort of doesn't feel like I'm necessarily missing something, because I know that everyone else, like, well, across the country pretty much in a lot of sectors is in this situation. So that sort of maybe made it easier to be doing this. And we've, you know, now tried to, we've thought of using different software and technologies and to try and create more, to make the creative process a bit easier and create more kind of casual social conversations within the structure of the workday. I think that's been a big shift throughout the year.
Yeah, it's, as you said, pretty early on in the girl career, so it's hard to exactly like pinpoint things that we're missing. But definitely a strange thing has been kind of learning about almost like office etiquette, but it being online. So like learning how to speak in like online meetings as opposed to in real life ones is really quite funny to think about. But like I've got my kind of Zoom etiquette down before my like real life meeting etiquette down. So yeah, that's definitely going to be with going back into the office and kind of like understanding how, even just stuff like how to present things like to the team. At the moment, it's very much a screen share situation. It'll be interesting when that's kind of more or less formal, depending. I've literally never seen the office except in photos. I'm sure it's the same with Melissa. So I wouldn't even know how we'd go about like presenting a report in real life. So that's definitely going to be really strange.
There's the usual kerfuffle about, should we do the screen? Should we just do it on laptops? I mean, I actually don't miss that bit. But I tell you, one of the things that it struck me just in the last couple of weeks, because I didn't work with either one of you directly, really, on a lot of stuff, but I don't know what drives you. Like, I don't know what you're really interested in or what is the kind of like, you know, what to kind of direct your way in a sense. And that is the kind of thing that I would pick up through just general conversations, through seeing you like at other events, like seeing whether you were really like engaged with something or if you were like, oh my God, how can I stay awake through this APPG on something or other? And I think, you know, one of the great things about the work that we can do at LJU, we're very privileged to be able to do, is to follow some of our own passions, not all the time, but a lot of the time, and more than in many jobs. But for someone who's in a new career, I am kind of like, I would normally be like, oh, hey, there's this thing that you would be really interested in. And I don't have any idea what you are interested in. You're missing out on something that you didn't even know you were necessarily missing out on. And that just kind of casual mentorship or sharing. Yeah, it's a strange thing. And I suppose as a more senior person, I didn't think through that either. Like, how does that relationship change? And how did I, you know, how does that role change in a virtual space? So maybe something for listeners to get back to us on and to reflect on how they've done it successfully or not. I also wanted to, both of you have been working on stuff that is not necessarily where you are, you, Melissa, more than you, Lucy, but you've both been pulling together some of our newsletter products. You have been working on Australian Daily News. Lucy, you've been working on the Global Pandemic Bulletin. So you're getting to go all around the world, not always with the best, in the best circumstances, while sitting in your room or your office. What has that been like?
Yeah, I think that's been noticeable for me because I'm writing the Australian news most days and very immersed in it because I'm having to do a lot of research about lots of different Australian news publications. And I think I sometimes end up in a strange situation that I feel like I know better what's happening day to day. It's within the local government sphere, at least, in Australia than sometimes I do here, which is a very odd situation just because that's what's been sort of filling my brain. But I think with Australia's response to the pandemic, like there have been other issues rather than just COVID, which people are thinking about. Like, that's a big, obviously, environmental issues massively on the agenda. Lots of bushfire stuff happening, but just kind of, I guess, more normal, like planning stuff and things. So in some ways, I mean, it varies, but sometimes it's almost kind of refreshing to be looking at things in a place that's in a slightly different stage, to England, and useful to kind of gauge like insights into what we might be needing to think about in terms of things like economic recovery, for example, in like the next 6 months to a year. But yeah, definitely feel like my head's sort of in different places with it, which is interesting and refreshing.
I'd honestly echo really similar sentiments to what Melissa said. I think it's almost as though, because I'm like in this bubble in my room all the time, and when I write the Global Pandemic Bulletin, I have as much idea of kind of what's going on in the rest of the world as I do here, because it's my job, obviously. And it's really changed like my perspective, I think, than if, not that the same thing could be happened without us being in lockdown, but because of the way it is, and I'm not like speaking to that many people about it outside of work and that kind of thing, it's really given me a very different perspective than if kind of I was like doing stuff more at home. So it's been like a really interesting and like kind of strange time will be experience.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're probably, I don't know when we'll be getting back to the office. I guess sometime in the late summer, I don't know. So you'll be over a year in a new job without ever darkening the doorway of the office. What do you think that you will take away from this that's positive?
I think you have to motivate yourself day to day to work remotely. And sometimes that's a challenge, but like, I think some days that's kind of, it's, I don't know, makes you think about how you work and be like, I can do this. Like, I don't need necessarily these specific conditions in order to be able to like work effectively and stuff. And I think that's quite a boost, like being able to have been so flexible and adaptable and self-driven at various stages. And I think there are good things, like there are interesting things about remote working and kind of things that have come up through our channels and the way we approach things. Yeah, I think there are some things to hold on to. But yeah, with a bit more spontaneity, I think would be the big thing.
Yeah, I think definitely just one thing I completely agree with is that like we can do remote working. It completely works. Everything still functions. Obviously, it's not ideal that we have to be solely remote working, but knowing that kind of everything can still work with this kind of level of flexibility, obviously kind of lesser relevance for me, but for other people who have like childcare responsibilities or other caring responsibilities, kind of knowing that this flexibility still works for everyone and we can kind of still have these kinds of team events and it still works is like really valuable. As well as that, I think like a kind of resilience that everyone is acquiring right now, just keeping on going with kind of the stress of the pandemic continuing in the back of our minds and various other responsibilities.
Well, yeah, we still have a little ways to go, but so far so good. And then this is the last question. I'm going to put you on the spot. Tomorrow, everything goes back to the way it was before. Like we can get on a train without a mask or whatever. How many days a week do you come in?
At the moment, I'm thinking I come in 2 or 3 days a week. But that's, I think, because it's going to be a bit of adjustment. Like, I think it's going to be a bit of a shock the first time I get on a train and go into London and, like, I'm surrounded by people and stuff. But also, I work slightly odd days. So there are some days when I work that not everyone else is in the office. And I don't need to be in the office by myself. That would be
No.
really depressing. So, yeah, that's my thought at the moment, but we'll see.
The trains will be emptier.
That's true. That's true. Empty train to empty office. But yeah.
Yeah, Lucy, how about you?
I honestly think I'm so desperate for kind of human connection right now. I'd be in every day that you let me. If I'm sure I'd regret setting that precedent after a couple of weeks, but yeah, I'm just really, really excited to have some random social interactions in work, on my way to work, on my way back from work. Very excited for that.
Yeah, I hear you. I miss reading on the underground. That is where I did most of my reading, was a reading for pleasure or whatever. Yeah. And I just haven't been able to pick it up. So there you go. Anyway, thanks so much. And I would say I'm looking forward to seeing you soon, but I don't know how soon. I'll see you online soon though. And thanks very much.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
you.
Yeah, it was so interesting talking to them because I realized that I'd had very little chit chat with them over the last year that I would have done normally.
It was the bit where the conversation about how tall people were that really sort of brought it home to me. It's like, oh God, they've never seen any of us. They've only ever seen anyone that they work with in a sort of head and shoulders. Yeah, they've never seen more than the head and shoulders of anyone. It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And of course, again, that's an experience that will have been replicated out in the world, out in local government by all our members, far, far more than it has been for us, and has become. It is a challenge as we look forward. I mean, I'm very conscious that a lot of our, it's been fairly easy to take two new people on, I think, because they were coming into a fairly established team. We have fairly kind of quite a lot of continuity at LJU. We don't cycle people in. People tend to, I like to think, because it's a nice place to work, people tend to stick around for a bit. So by and large, we have a team of people who know each other quite well, who have good relationships, but relationships that were all kind of built up in pre-COVID times. We've sat in the same office for years. We've been on endless train journeys together. We've been on trips. We've done events. We've
A
had
lot of
sort
drinks receptions
of,
and
one or two
yeah.
drinks receptions. Yeah, I mean, a lot of drinks receptions, not a lot of drinks, obviously. But we've
Listeners, I really wish you could see my face
but quite a bonded team in one way or another. And I don't know. Does that make it easier? Or I think that's definitely made it easier for us to work together remotely, because we had that kind of social capital, that sort of cohesion developed before then. does that make it easier or harder for people to come in remotely? I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, we've done our best to kind of, I don't know. I think it's really difficult. And does that capital start to sort of erode over time now that it's been a year since any of us have actually seen each other? Again, I don't know. Not yet, I think, but at some point that must.
It's really strange because in some ways I feel much more distant from people that I normally worked face to face with at least several days a week, but I feel much closer to the people that we have that are based in Scotland or Ireland, for example, because I actually have more contact with them now than I did before. So it goes both ways.
Exactly. And you know, as and when we emerge from all this, we need to think about all of that. Think about how we retain those positives, and that how we retain that connection with people who are further away. You know, we have colleagues in Australia now. We're never going to be seeing them on a daily basis. So how do we retain that kind of closeness across distance whilst also bringing back some of the kind of connection that comes from actually being places and doing things together? And I don't think, you know, again, I think that's a challenge for us here at LGRU, but I think that's a general challenge. I think it's probably, I don't want to be complacent. I think we're a small team, we're a fairly close team. I think that's probably less of a challenge for us than it is for larger organizations. And I think it's going to be very, I mean, there's been a bit about this in the press recently, which I think is good. A couple of the councils that I work with on their sort of recovery groups and looking at how to come back, one of the points I've been making is that I think for a long time in this, we sort of treated the end of it as, you know, and then there will be a kind of this moment of liberation where we kind of just go back and everything's okay and we'll be happy, you know. And actually, I don't think it will be like that. I think the transition back to whatever it is we transition back to, I think for many people, that's going to be quite traumatic, actually. I think there's going to be a re-traumatizing effect of kind of trying to move back into, you know, whether it's in a blended way, some of the time in the office, some of the time not. But, you know, we're not going to be in our homes forever. I mean, there will be trips, you know. I mean, I'm not just talking about LJU, I'm talking about everyone. Yeah, even if people don't go back to full-time office working, there will still be meetings. There will still be times you go places. There will still be, you know, there's still going to be a first time you get on a bus or a tube or a train or. And I think for a lot of people, it's going to be quite challenging, even if you've been vaccinated, even if you've been not necessarily challenging in terms of worries about your health, though, of course, that still exists. But just we have all kind of desocialized. We're not used to being so near to people. And, you know, and I thought this, I was, you know, every month we look at everything we've done in the month and we review it and we think, you know, what worked, what didn't work, how, you know, who did our, particularly with our publications, who read that, how many people did it reach, what could we do better, you know, as part of our kind of attempts to constantly be sort of delivering as much as we can to our members. And when we did that for February a couple of weeks ago, and then we looked back, Jen, our colleague Jen, said, right, and here's last February, because we often do that, how does this compare with this time last year? And I was just amazed at how many places I'd been and how out in the world. I went to that thing in Nottingham and that thing in Warwickshire. And then I went to Australia for LGRU Australia. That's quite far. But even without that, there was just this constant, you know, kind of. And then I think I was in Bristol and Nottingham. And so, and I just sort of thought, God, I can't believe I used to go so many places and be so many places. And I sort of miss that and don't miss that in almost equal measure. And some of that won't come back, I think, because I think there will be some meetings that we used to do face to face that, you know, once we wouldn't have thought twice about jumping on a train to go and see someone. Now we just say, well, we'll jump on a video call. Why would we spend hours moving across the country? I mean, I sort of miss that time on trains again as well.
Yeah.
I don't think the sort of movement, I don't think we're going back, I guess, is what I'm saying. We're going forward to somewhere new, and I think that's going to be quite difficult, potentially. And I think we need to think about how, you know, we as an organisation and our members as councils, as organisations, and our members as councils thinking about the businesses in their community and their communities need to think through that kind of, that that reinsertion into sort of something more like normal life and how that works. I think that's going to be.
We're going to have to rethink connection, I think.
And I think so, no?
I just, you know, segue right into that kind of connection and story, because we wouldn't have done this time last year. We just did our online book club for LGIU, where we take a book that's not necessarily about local government.
Everything's about local government. As but we've discovered, when you look hard enough, it's all about local government.
Exactly. You bring the local government people together. But it's quite good because like you're kind of coming at the issues that we all care about, but from a slightly different direction. And we were reading How to Stay Sane in an Age of Division by Elif Shafak, which was fantastic.
It was fantastic. I mean, I mean, just yeah. If people take away nothing else from this podcast, they should read that book if they haven't read it. It's just I thought it was wonderful, and this is not
quick. It's wonderful as well.
It is. I'm just looking. 90 pages. It's 90 small pages. So it's a, you know, it's a.
Oh, and she writes so well. It's just like you fly wonderful. Through it. You fly
it's
through
absolutely
it.
Wonderful. Yeah, I loved it. And you know, she talks a lot about the sort of polarization of discourse in politics and you know, the risks of sort of getting stuck in a sort of echo chamber and the sort of what she calls the sort of collective narcissism of that and the anxiety that produces and the anger it produces and when and how anger is and isn't an appropriate response to the world and what to do with it. And this sort of move towards what she calls a kind of conscious optimism about, you know, not giving in to the despair of all of this, but trying to sort of, you know, forge a way forward in the world that recognizes, that embraces complexity, that gets beyond a kind of black and white view of who's right and who's wrong, and just tries to sort of see the best in societies, in people, and in people collectively. And I thought it was, you know, it's a wonderful book. It's a wonderful book.
Yeah, but it's not Pollyanna-ish. It's not like oh, it's all going to be good and groovy. But it's like we can still find connection, and we can find connection through. What really struck me from a local government perspective was shared space, and where people can kind of commune in the space. And that part of this week has been people sharing photos of where they've been in shared space during lockdown. Which is really lovely.
All of this, we should say, people can go to our website and check all this out. So you can see the photo gallery. You can see Sue's poems, the Sue's poem that we opened the pod with, all the other stuff.
Yeah, and more poetry. And in fact, a short story.
Lots of poetry.
A short story as well.
Yep.
Which is
some films, some music. Some. Mm-hmm. Just as a side rant, I really love this because I think, you know, one of the things, you know, what, you know, LGIU is a membership body, we're a think tank. What do think tanks do? They write reports, they run roundtables, they do conferences. And there's nothing wrong with any of that. And we've spent years doing that. You know, great analysis, graphs, data, you know, all good. But actually this week, we're also bringing in poetry, music, film, because actually underneath all of this are people. And you know, this year has been a shared human experience that is as much about how we feel and how we have sort of processed this and the sort of emotional and psychological impact as it is about public policy or data or anything. So I'm really proud of the fact that the team have put together this really interesting, but I think kind of formally innovative approach to sort of getting behind some of the questions that the pandemic raises, some of the questions about equality, the questions about community, the questions, as you say, about public space, all of which seem particularly sharp-edged this week. I think that kind of that range of material, trying to look at this from different perspectives and through different media, is really wonderful.
Yeah, and I think that story element, whether it's a story of like a short story or through poetry, which is often like a really good way of expressing a story in a really small number of characters, is how we can reflect and think through to the next set of policy or to the next set of finding ways of working. And it helps us as humans really look at policy and policy impact in a completely different way.
I think that must be true. And it's not just us that thinks that, of course. Yeah, that's happening out there. One of our member councils, Dumfries and Galloway, members of LGU Scotland, picked up on exactly that point that you're making. And so they took the opportunity of working with an author called Karen Campbell, who's published various novels, and she became, they used an arts program, she became the writer in residence there at the council, precisely to do that, to sort of craft stories about what it's been like working in the front line. And as you say, we are publishing one of her stories this week in our Pandemic Unlocked. So she's very, very kindly given us a sort of exclusive sort of preview of her collection with a short story that is published first on our website. And you were fortunate enough to talk to her.
I was, and it was a really great conversation. She speaks like you would hope a writer would speak. Let's have a listen.
Hello, my name's Karen Campbell. I'm a writer, a novelist. I'm from Glasgow originally, but I live in Galloway in the southwest of Scotland now.
And what have you been doing for the past year?
Well, I've been writer in residence at Dumfries and Galloway Council, which has been a really interesting period for me. I've been talking to staff, obviously normally with a residency you'd be in situ, but that's not been possible. So everything's been done remotely, but my job's basically been to speak to staff about what it's been like for them working during the pandemic, how it's impacted on them professionally and personally. A lot of people haven't been working, some have been working from home, some have been shielding. And what I was trying to do was just get a sense of the kind of, you know, personal impacts behind professional decisions. And also just because I used to work for Glasgow City Council, I've got a sort of local authority head on as well. And I just know what it's like working in a council. You do a lot of graft. Don't often get a lot of thanks. A lot of it's behind the scenes. And then, you know, this year the world's been kind of turned topsy-turvy, and we've had folk out on doorsteps clapping for bin men and things like that. So it's been a really strange period emotionally as well as practically for people working in local authorities. And I just wanted to try and capture some of that.
Can you tell us a little bit about how this came to be and how this project was initiated, and what's the idea behind it?
Sure. It's part of a wider arts project called Atlas Pandemica, which is across Dumfries and Galloway, and it's managed by an arts collective based in Dumfries called The Stove. And the funding for it came from the Scottish Government. I think it was Supporting Communities Fund. And the idea was that 10 artists across the region, it was a case of, you know, putting in proposals and being interviewed. So there was lots and lots of ideas came forward, but ultimately 10 artists from across the region were chosen to respond creatively in different ways to the pandemic. So we've got one of our gang, Peter is designing Zen gardens as places of contemplation. We've got Joanne, who is charting the history of other pandemics that came to Dumfries, things like the Spanish flu and cholera, and also making her own paper to write poetry on. We've had responses about how grief is dealt with remotely, since people, you know, can't go to funerals as normal. And there was a really moving waterside ceremony for that that kind of went across the world. So there's been all different approaches. My approach right from the outset was, because I'm a writer and because I have a local authority background, the idea of being writer in residence at the council just seemed a good fit. So I approached the council and offered my services and kind of, I didn't have to sell it actually. I mean, they were really, really supportive. The communities directorate was the host, and they've all been just great in terms of getting the point of what I was trying to do, and as far as possible facilitating me speaking to as broad a range of people as possible, which, you know, has been tricky because I couldn't go and set up in an office somewhere on site and have folk drop in. It's had to be You know, they recorded video messages for me to broadcast across the staff intranet. They keyed me into various communications groups that I could talk to. And yeah, just slowly I managed to sort of get footholds across the council. So, you know, education, social work, finance, as well as communities. And yeah, it's been sort of 4 months of gathering the stories, then another 2 or 3 months after that, actually writing them up.
Now, I know, and you know, because we've both worked in local government or with local government, that there are a lot of really interesting stories in councils and in that kind of work. And as you said, they're behind the scenes. What would you say to people who don't have a local government background, which is, to be fair, most of you know, that is our listenership. What would you say to people who are outside of it, though? Like, what's compelling about stories in local government?
Yeah, I think before I was in local government, I was actually a police officer in Glasgow. So I suppose local government was easier than the police, but it's the same sort of sense of people not really knowing what's going on behind the scenes, in terms of people having opinions based on the most recent interaction, whether it's about, you know, potholes or not getting your bins put back in the right place, or, you know, it tends to be the council kind of works invisibly until something goes wrong, and then people are very quick to say, oh, you know, this needs to be addressed. And I think there's always a bit of a sense too that local authorities are kind of backwaters, that people are jobs worthy and kind of by the book and not very innovative, and that's just the antithesis of local government. There's so many, you know, dynamic people in the organisations, and there's so much desire to make communities a better place. And, you know, obviously resourcing can be an issue in terms of making those things happen, but the will is there and the commitment is definitely there. And so I suppose I was a bit, I didn't want to be on my soapbox. As a writer, you never want to sort of be saying, you know, I'm telling the story so you think this way. I just wanted to shine a light on the fact that, you know, it could be the most simple story, like somebody, a member of staff who's been drafted onto working on the shielding team. So you're listening to people calling, you know, lonely, worried, needing practical assistance. And that's your job and that's fine. But, you know, there was this one individual who on her day off went to one of the callers' houses, with their permission, obviously, but to deliver a bunch of leeks because the old lady wanted to make soup. And our food parcels never had leeks in them. So this person just took it on themselves to kind of, you know, take the switchboard head off and just be a human being. And that's replicated all the time in local authorities. So I think it's those wee moments. And I think as a writer, that's true of anything I've ever worked on. It's illuminating really small, humane moments that in the scheme of things aren't hugely heroic. But in terms of that idea of public service and being a servant in the proper sense of giving, I'm not sure that enough people appreciate how much that goes on within councils. So, you know, it was a real privilege actually to get the chance to creatively examine that, and by telling stories rather than, you know, again, councils, a lot of report writing, a lot of
yep.
heavy stuff to wade through, and this was, it's not trivializing it by making fiction. But what it did was it allowed me to kind of see the bigger picture and to sometimes splice two or three stories together and to tell a, you know, there was one story I wrote about the library service, but I managed to incorporate two or three different people within the service that I spoke to in that one story. And it was showing different ways of working even within one library and in one service. But just also it allowed staff to be honest with me, because they, you know, they weren't going to see their name in lights. It was very much trusting me to take what they told me, and maybe just, you know, what one thing I wrote a whole story about, and it was just one incident a lady contacted me about in terms of working from home and feeling really out of it and kind of not part of the blitz spirit, if you like, that seemed to be going on everywhere else. And her issue was that she had a conversation with her manager about a meeting that she was convinced she hadn't had. And her manager's like, we spoke about this last week. And she genuinely thought she was going mad. And it was just because she wasn't in her work environment and because she was working from her kitchen table, she found it really hard to get a handle on things. And it was almost like she was in a dreamlike state, and she was still doing her work. But you know, that is when you're driving and you, it's automatic pilot, and you think, oh gosh, I forgot turning into the street. She was kind of working in that mode. And I managed to take that one wee thing that she got in touch about and write a whole story about it. So yeah, just moments like that, I think, where I think also taking barriers away, you know, the council can often be seen as either people that are, you know, the Jobsworth, as I say, that dispense resources or dispense wisdom or close the barriers or the gates to the public accessing things that they want. And very much through this pandemic, I got that sense that those delineations had just gone, and that if you happened to work for the council and you lived in your community, you were the go-to for advice about anything to do with, you know, lockdown or shielding or whatever. And also you were tending to more go into bat for your community. So that was really interesting too. And that was an aspect I hadn't thought I would uncover till I started speaking to people.
Well, I think, it sounds wonderful. And I've read one of the stories and it's absolutely wonderful. And that will be on our website. We'll come in a little bit into how people can read the whole thing. But I wanted to touch on the creative process. What has that been like for you, talking to people and then turning them into stories? And especially, you know, you just mentioned that the woman who's been working in a dreamlike state. I feel like I'm still in March of last year. How has it been like working in the same conditions that we're all working in, the remote, the isolation, all that?
To be honest, I found at the start of lockdown, it was really tough to be a writer. I felt normally as a writer, you know, your job is to escape into your own head and create new worlds, irrespective of what your book's about or where it's set. You're making people up from scratch and you're kind of being the puppet master. But with the real world outside being so crazy and so just everything sort of slipping and you know, it was like being in one of those snow globes and everything just upside down. I found it really hard to retreat into writing and to be productive, because it felt a wee bit indulgent maybe, but it also felt like I don't know what to write about, because normally I've got one historical novel, but normally what I write is contemporary fiction. And I didn't want to address COVID. I didn't want to write a book about COVID. I'm sure every writer's having the same problem at the moment, but it's the elephant in the room and outside the room that you just can't ignore, and you can't be writing about the world without acknowledging it. So doing this project, it was really good for me creatively. It kind of unlocked that blockage, because it was like I had permission, because it was part of this project, to do nothing but think about COVID, but through the eyes of other people that were dealing with it in different ways. And so it was freeing for me as a writer, and also this idea of, you know, sometimes you write things from scratch, other times you take fragments of real life. So I was taking real people's lives and real experiences, but they were all really good at agreeing at the outset, this doesn't have to be verbatim, this is a sense of what it's been like for me, do with it what you will. So I was able to have that kind of framework and that material, if you like, but then do what I liked with it in terms of fleshing things out, or you know, sometimes I change the gender of the person in the story, sometimes I decided it would be in the second person, like there's a couple of stories that are all in the you voice, and that maybe just was the way that conversation with that person went, that if they felt almost it was cathartic for them, they were getting something off their chest, it was coming out in a hurry, that was kind of the way I was writing it. So a personality of the real person might shine through, but actually the fact of the story might not. So I think, you know, with all art, that's kind of the best way you make it, is that it's rooted in truth in terms of human responses to the world. But it's where you take that and what you do with it and how you package it. I don't mean in a glib way. I mean, like, you know, how you frame it, how you start and end a story, where the kind of the curve of the arc is of that moment of revelation or whatever. what you try and do with that is tell a bigger truth, like dropping a stone in water, and then, you know, the ripples come out from that. The short story is just a small thing, but you want it to be resonant on a wider scale. So it allowed me to have lots of different voices, but I still had some degree of control in terms of sort of stitching it together. And even when I put the anthology together, I was thinking about how I placed the stories, what story would feed into the next one. And I tried to do it kind of chronologically in terms of, if people had told me things about the start of the pandemic, that was near the start of the book, but also thematically. And it could be just a little hint. For example, one person in an office was bemoaning the fact that they were having to work there. It was empty and it was so drab because there was none of the flower boxes that are usually filled outside. Everything was empty. And then the next story was the one I wrote about the gardener who had to shield, but got the young girl in the office at the nursery part of the council that he worked in every day to do a video call with him. He learned how to do a video call so he could supervise what the bedding would be for, you know, coming through the seasons. So that was taking my creativity in places that I wouldn't have been able to do if I hadn't had that generosity of spirit from the council officers and workers. And just that, yeah, that way of containing all of this within the idea of COVID and the council response, but ultimately having the freedom just to write about people and about human emotions.
That's wonderful. How can people read this?
Well, at the moment, they're still just on my laptop. I'm very pleased that the Dumfries and Galloway Council have agreed to print a limited amount, and they will be really for things like local libraries, obviously going to people that participated in the project, you know, elected members, and just for use within the council, really. And once that's done, which I think will be in the next month or so, what we're planning to do is put the PDF of that, I guess, onto the Atlas Pandemica website, which is the website for this wider arts project. So you can see all of the different, a flavour at least of all of the different projects that have been taking place in D&G, as well as read the stories.
That sounds fantastic. Thank you so much, Karen. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, right. So, fantastic. And as you say, it's everything one would hope for from a teller of stories. You've also been hearing a local government stories this week.
Yeah, I mean, straight from a leader, Abby Brown, the leader of Stoke-on-Trent, who I spoke to not quite a year ago, almost a year ago, just in May, just as we thought we were coming out of this.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was talking about recovery and about leading to the next phase. And then, well, we know what happened.
Yes.
And she's just wonderful to talk to about what it's been like leading through this crisis.
Great. Well, let's hear from her.
So I'm Councillor Abby Brown and I'm the leader of Stoke-on-Trent City Council.
It's been quite a year, hasn't it? I spoke to you not quite a year ago when it looked like we were maybe coming out of this, and here we are again.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember it well, actually. It was sunny and I was sitting outside at the time, and I think if we hadn't exited lockdown, we thought we were close to. And, you know, obviously since then we've been through a fairly dramatic autumn and then, you know, a pretty hard and tough winter, really. So, yeah, now we're into spring and hopefully things are looking better.
Yeah, let's hope this time we finally get out, at least with the vaccine on the horizon. It's certainly much more hopeful. Now, how has it been leading a council through that moment of hope into a kind of winter of despair, I guess?
I think probably like everybody else, fairly tricky. I think, you know, for me personally, probably more difficult. It's hard to compare yourself, isn't it, to other counsellors. But I think, you know, I had the experience in October of asking for my local authority to put up a tier. And, you know, these decisions are not easy, are they? You know, and I think perhaps regardless of your political views, when we look at what the Prime Minister's gone through, I'm not sure any of us in local government necessarily are envious, because it's been really tough in our own places without imagining having to make those decisions on a bigger footprint. And, you know, for me, the decision to have to ask to move up a tier was fairly momentous, not easily taken. I had an argument with my Director of Public Health over it. I remember, as you know, having having quite a frank exchange of views early one morning over the phone about it, when he was saying to me, I think we really need to do this. And I'd say, but you know, people will hate this. And, you know, as good officers do, they, you know, explain to you why, they give you options, and we came to an agreement and we wrote the letter. And, you know, the fallout from that was so horrendous, I actually took myself off social media for a week. But I reflect back on that now, and it was absolutely the right thing to do. And, you know, I know that hopefully in years to come, it will all be forgotten anyway. And there's probably some people out there who are still probably dwelling on it now. Somebody called me the most dangerous person in Stoke-on-Trent, but it was the right thing to do. But at that moment, it was incredibly difficult as a decision. However, you know, as I say, I look back on that now and I think I'm so pleased I did make that decision, because things have got better for Stoke-on-Trent since making the honest reflection that things were going the wrong direction. And clearly, you know, that's what happened to the Prime Minister as well, just a week later.
Yeah, it's important in leadership to like understand that balance between, well, really conflicting needs in the community, because we all need connection, we all need to make a living, but we all need to stay healthy and stay alive too. And occasionally we have to, you know, we need a bit of guidance and leadership to remind us what can help keep our neighbors safe.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, probably as a leader of a city council, we've probably had greater engagement with residents than we've ever had. Certainly that's what my PA says to me, as she tells me off for once again, you know, sharing my email address when I do a regular weekly phone in. But I do think that people have, they have looked for leadership, and you know, certainly I hope that I've stepped up to provide it. But I think for everyone across the whole of the local government sector, it's really reminded residents about what we do and the services we provide, and actually in our own small way, how important we are to their lives. But equally, you know, the flip side of that is we have had far greater engagement with businesses, with individuals, with community groups, with stakeholders than we've ever had. And I think that's a real positive out of the last year. I've got some really strong relationships with groups and organisations and individuals and businesses that I didn't have before, and new understandings that I'll take forward and that will help me be a better leader and hopefully make my city be a better city.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of people who are looking back at what was a very hard year and thinking about what has been good. And that, you know, one of the many councillors have said that increased engagement has been a good thing. Not that anyone would wish what we've been through on, you know, to happen. Have there been other things, either on an organizational level or as a politician, that you think you've gained through this experience?
I think probably on an organizational level, we've proved, and I think this is again true across the entire local government, that you can actually do stuff. And we've done it. We've all done it. We've all moved over to being virtual in terms of what we do. So I think there is the organisational benefit of doing that. And also, you know, there will be local benefits around that. 80% of our workforce here in Stoke-on-Trent is working from home today. You know, will we be bringing everybody back into buildings? I don't think we will be. And similarly, people have accessed services in a different way. You know, I received a message, I think last week, from some residents who'd really enjoyed the engagement with libraries. Our libraries have operated on a click, call and collect basis for probably most of the last year, but have also had a lot of their resources online that have been more greatly accessed as a download. We had that available before, but perhaps people weren't as aware, or it was too difficult to do it, and people have really embraced that. So I think there is that, and you know, again, for me personally, probably that greater resilience of needing to rely on your own instincts at times, but also key people around you, and probably also the push to do things that you might have been scared about before. And one of my biggest things that that we've done here in Stoke-on-Trent over the last year is I do a weekly Facebook Live. In fact, I'm going to do it in the next hour. Something I'd kind of toyed with doing before, always been very keen on social media. And I had some advice from a really good journalist who I really respected just probably, you know, beginning of last year when I was thinking about doing it in the run-up to our budget. And he just said to me, don't do it, Abby. You know, someone will freeze frame you and you'll be a meme then. I had to go away, obviously, and get my teenage children to explain to you what a meme was. but I was like, no, you're right. That's a boundary too far. But of course, when we entered the first lockdown, and you're kind of, well, I really want to engage with people. And I'm really lucky. I have a fantastic director of public health who is so complimentary to me in style. Paul Edmondson-Jones, he's a former, he's a Falklands veteran. He's a medical doctor. And he's fantastic. And we are quite a double act. I think, you know, we style ourselves a bit as the Phil and Holly of Stoke-on-Trent. And, you know, we've been doing the Facebook Live. He doesn't always do it with me, but he's my most regular co-host. And the first one we did was so heavily scripted. We did a rehearsal. We were in a room. We perfectly mapped out. Now, literally, we will like do it at 5 minutes notice. So you're going to do the Facebook Live in 5 minutes. Haven't even read the script. And we just do it. And I think, you know, we've become so confident at doing it. And as an organisation, we've got very slick at doing it now as well, with that, whilst also retaining the authenticity that I think you need on social media. And again, you know, it's really good, it's really powerful, and it's actually quite enjoyable to do too. So I think, you know, some unexpected things perhaps in there that I wouldn't have done before, but definitely, you know, I really enjoy doing now.
Yeah, I think one of those things that we've worried for a long time about how, if we put communications on social media, is it excluding someone? And now, you know, people can recognize that actually all channels are excluding. But now that we've all been at home, you know, the person who couldn't come to a meeting or couldn't come into the town hall can now, you know, hear from councillors, local leaders, and be a part of that conversation. Obviously, there's some caveats we've seen with social media, some difficulties as well. But no, I think that's wonderful. I wanted to ask you as well about loss. As a leader, as a local leader, you're often expected to lead or take part, a big part, in commemorations and remembrances. And we've had a lot of loss through this crisis. What has that role been like? And
I think it's been tricky, and clearly it will continue to be difficult. I think as the leader, there are certain things that you are expected to attend and that you have your own expectation of attending. I'm not sure I've described it as necessarily a highlight, but certainly one of the things that I have been fortunate to do, both because I understudied for leaders in the past, but also obviously I'm the leader now, was attending Remembrance Day. And I wasn't able to attend Remembrance Day last year because I was actually in isolation. I didn't have COVID. I've been very fortunate in that I haven't actually caught COVID. I did have to go into isolation several days beforehand, which meant that I wasn't able to attend. And I found that really difficult because I've done it so many times, because I recognise the importance of it, because it's important to me. I having to watch it through a screen was quite upsetting in a way, but it was important for me to take part. Obviously, we are roughly now at the 1 year anniversary, and as a city, we are planning a Garden of Remembrance. It's underway at the moment, and we will be having a little ceremony in a couple of weeks' time, and I will be looking forward to attending that along with our Lord Mayor and a very small number of other dignitaries as well as part of that. And I think that's really important, isn't it? You realise, I think, probably over the last year, how many other people are almost living their lives through what you do. I've been quite taken at times by the level of interest in what I do now. And clearly some of that is maybe a little vexatious, you know, so why are you out when I can't go out? Or who said you could go and do that? But also people who've contacted me to say thank you for doing that. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, particularly with the Facebook Lives, although, you know, we at the moment we're doing quite a lot of them indoors. I've done them in a variety of places. I took our Facebook Live to one of our homeless shelters and spoke to the people who ran it. Also to where we distributed food parcels from and spoke to their staff who were organising and distributing those. I think, you know, that that has given people, hasn't it, an insight and a reminder of what life's like. And I think, you know, the, particularly the messages from people who've been shielding basically for the last year, and you forget how difficult that is. You know, whilst we might feel quite sad about the fact that perhaps we haven't seen our parents, but we've been able to go out, some people, they haven't been out for 12 months, have they? No. So I think, you know, that those opportunities that you can give into that glimpse of what's going on in the world, I think are hugely important for people. And also, as you say, you know, the role as leader that you are playing on behalf of the rest of your residents, of commemorating and remembering all those people who have lost their lives and all the people who've worked on the front line all the way through this. And, you know, I think one of the highlights of my year has actually been talking to our staff who've been absolutely brilliant. And they message me on social media. They invite me to go and do things with them. And that's really lovely. And I think it's just as important for them, isn't it, as well, that they feel that what they're doing has been reflected back to everybody else.
Yeah, because I think, I mean, most of our listenership is pretty well inside local government and knows that the work that council staff and councillors have been doing over the last year. And I think the public, too, have a little bit of idea. But yeah, the heroic efforts of what people have been doing, or even now, you know, putting on the elections during this time when it's a challenge. And it won't seem like it's a challenge when we get to May, but we know that it has been, and we should appreciate, you know, people are essentially risking their lives so we can vote.
Yeah, absolutely. I think probably that's part of it, isn't it? You know, this adaptation to seeing inside the life of the council in a very different way. You know, I know myself as a politician that often, you know, your preoccupation with the election is actually around the count. But actually then, as the leader of the council, and I've been the portfolio holder responsible for a number of services, including elections, for the last 5 years, there's so much more to it. Elections don't start, you know, on polling day. They don't even start on the day when the declaration is of the election is published. You know, they started months before. So I think, you know, that whole kind of range of things that go into delivering, whether it's elections or anything else, in fact, you know, we have started to show that, haven't we, to the public? And I think they've really welcomed that, and I think there's a real interest in it.
Yeah, I mean, it is for them and by them, and so they kind of should see into the sausage factory a little bit. So no, I think that has been a benefit of the year. I guess it's been such a strange crisis in that we've all been going through it, but we all have our own kind of separate hidden stories in a way. And I'm sure even though you've been quite public, that's been a feature for you as well, you know, just as a human person living your life in a very different way than you had been.
I think it has been, as you say, you know, an opportunity to share things in a different way. And I'm kind of very taken as well with how it has influenced other people around me. So perhaps it is because of the kind of the different approach on social media sometimes, that the public, you know, are at home and they're interested in what else is going on that maybe they didn't see before. And I spotted that our highways team, they've had a Twitter account for quite a long time, but suddenly they've started to be a bit more engaging with it. And they will post little bits and pieces, and other members of the team will post things. You know, this is the piece of machinery that we use to do this, and this is why we did this here. And they will respond a bit more. And I think that's really good in a way, because I remember somebody saying to me when I first kind of went onto the cabinet, a council leader actually in another authority, and he said to me, you must never forget that when you criticise the council, you're criticising your own residents, because 80% of the people who work for Stoke-on-Trent City Council live here in Stoke-on-Trent. They're your residents. And that you, clearly, you know, when you're on the cabinet, you know, you are the council, you're running the council. But if you're a councillor, you are the council. So you have a duty of being fair and championing things that you think are right. And, you know, clearly, you know, I have to sometimes explain to journalists who want me to be outraged council leader that it isn't always possible to be like that with council services. My job is to make sure that everything works to the very best that I can do, but equally to remember that the people who actually make the magic happen in Stoke-on-Trent are those frontline workers the vast majority of whom are actually my residents too. So I think, you know, I'm really pleased that they feel confident and they feel proud to work for Stoke-on-Trent City Council, and that they want to share what they do as their job with other people out there. I think that's hugely liberating and really, really exciting actually for the future of local government, in a way that our frontline staff feel confident and proud and they want to talk about what they do, and they absolutely should do. I think it's brilliant.
Just the last question. It's been a lot of reflection, but let's look forward for a minute. And let's assume that the summer goes as well as we hope it does. How is Stoke going to be unlocked? What are you guys looking forward to?
So just over a week ago, we launched our Stoke-on-Trent prospectus, and this has been a kind of a little ambition of mine for several years. Stoke-on-Trent had a city deal a number of years ago, and I've been quite interested with the mechanisms around it and how we kind of got to it, because it happened before I came onto the cabinet, and it was something that I really wanted to replicate. So we've actually spent most of the last 12 months working on a package, a prospectus, that's what we've called it, our prospectus, as an opportunity for engagement and investment, and we launched it just over a week ago. I've spent quite a lot of time over the preceding time really talking to government ministers and stakeholders and people interested in the ideas in it. So for me, unlocking the city will be a continuation of that work. You know, we continued as a city to work all the way through the pandemic. You know, slightly bizarrely, in the summer I opened a hotel and also a city centre living offer, because we needed to progress. We need to progress with these things. And just because we had a pandemic didn't mean that everything literally stopped. Some things carried on. So, I'll be continuing to pursue the story of my city. I think, I'm really lucky. Well, I'm very lucky. I know it. I have a brilliant job. I lead a fantastic place that I absolutely love and that I'm passionate about. And we've got a compelling narrative that I will enjoy pursuing forward. And we've got lots of really exciting plans to move on. And I will enjoy sharing that with people and hopefully securing more investment and success for my city.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Abby.
It's okay, no problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's always great to hear from Abby. I think she gives a really interesting perspective on leadership, I think, because it's, although she wears this fairly lightly, I think it is really hard to pull off. It's this sort of combination of sort of vision and sort of eyes on the future, but actually really grounded in the sort of practicalities of running a place like Stoke on a day-to-day basis, and of, you know, making sure that that kind of, that you can't just have a grand highfalutin vision that doesn't connect back to or speak to. It needs to speak to the experiences and the aspirations of the residents of that place. And actually it's easy to do one or the other, but to try and hold both of those, I think is very inspiring. Let's finish with another poem.
Yeah, this one, another one from Sue Bird, this one called Glow, which is a bit more hopeful.
Alexanders are legion in the hedgerow, girding my shrunken world with lime green early sweetness. Broken stalks leak tangy sap, Roman celery. The lacy heads are starting to seed, spikier now, and everything this shape, dandelion heads, thistles, anything that hooks and sticks, evokes our invisible enemy, magnified on every screen. An artist has cast the particle in glass, 200 times actual size, so beautiful, the femme fatale of the virus world. Let's rethink this. Look, the seed heads are like clusters of stars. Gaze upwards, the generosity of the bright night sky will show us how to navigate this fearful newness.